Hey there, good morning. I'm Brooke Thomas, filling in for John Iadarola, who is out this week. Welcome to the Damage Report. But we have such a great show today because I am super excited for the first time to welcome Ida Rodriguez to our morning show.
Hey.
I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm excited to be here.
Yes, and so excited to talk to you. We've got a lot going on today. We're talking about, we are keeping the discussion of the Central Park Five, we're keeping that going. We're talking about these boys. We're talking about other victims that you may not have even known about because it's part of the narrative that I think accidentally gets hidden.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're talking about politics, a lot of politicians, a lot of town halls, a lot of questions being answered. New policy out for Julian Castro. So let's get going.
Yeah.
Sound good? Okay, so Julian Castro. He actually just released a plan to reform policing in the US, saying it's a way to honor the memory of lives cut short by police brutality during interactions with the police. So let's break it down. It's the People First Policing Plan, all right? And this is what he says. He says, we have on our hands a national crisis in public safety. If elected president, Julian Castro would treat this as the crisis it is, demanding of a federal response. This is Julian's plan to fix this broken system. Number one, end over-aggressive policing and combat racially discriminatory policing, excuse me. And that's broken down is in establishing national standards for the conduct of police officers and local departments that receive federal funding, we ensure that every police department in the United States establishes minimum standards for how their officers interact with community members. Those standards include combating racially discriminatory policing that leads to the disproportionately high number of black men who are killed by police. And then we go into step two, which is hold police accountable. And he kind of explains that as making changes in the federal government and saying, including the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division, he's gonna hold accountable law enforcement agencies for use of excessive force. And that process, he says, starts with transparency and data. So step three is start the healing process between communities and law enforcement, explaining that, saying with new policing guidelines and increased accountability, law enforcement and community members are better able to build a culture of trust. And he actually wants to use an executive order to demilitarize the police and work with state and local law enforcement to deprioritize enforcement of minor offenses that don't impact public safety in an effort to limit over-policing in communities. So a lot going on. There's a video I have of him as well, because as a lot of people pointed out, this is something he's been talking about since he launched his campaign. So take a look at something he said during his campaign launch.
If police in Charleston can arrest Dylan Roof after he murdered 9 people worshiping at Bible study without hurting him, then don't tell me that Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and Ayanna Jones and Eric Garner and Jason Carroll and Stephon Clark and Sandra Bland shouldn't still be alive today.
Wow. I thought this was strong. I thought the policy, I think that oftentimes politicians are wary of discussing issues within the ways we police in the United States.
So I think it's interesting because I do think it's a start.
Okay.
But I do think that we scapegoat the cops a lot. Like I think that the problem is deeper than that. It's a systemic issue and it goes all the way up to politics. I mean, haven't you guys seen The Wire? But it's so interesting to just blame police for what's going on, but not holding accountable what's above police because police officers are blue collar workers. And yes, a lot of the egregious acts they should be held accountable for as people and as civil servants, but we cannot ignore what is continuously enabling this problem. And I think that that is why we don't get to the solution, because it's easy to say we're going to demilitarize the police. Why are they in that situation in the first place?
In the first place, this is true.
You know, it's very, it's very political. I would like to see other things too. I want to see them investigating law enforcement and finding the people who belong to white supremacist groups and getting them out of there. The FBI did release a report saying that there were, there was an obscene number of police officers that belong to white supremacy groups and that they're doing that, the, you know, those groups, that group's work. I think it's just very, I love it. I'm glad that somebody's actually talking about it, because I think that talking about it is the beginning. Mm-hmm. But I think that some of the stuff seems a little bit idealistic.
You think so?
Yeah, like how are you going to reduce aggressive behavior where people who are improperly trained and innately aggressive in the first place, and that's probably why they're being hired as police officers. You know, there's an education that needs to go in. There's also the zoning. Like, why are you putting police officers that are not familiar with the hood in the hood? That's probably the bigger problem, you know. And when you really want to create community relationships, I met with LAPD. We were supposed to be working on something to actually create inroads, creating more opportunities for officers of color, of people of color, women of color, so that those communities are being policed by people who are familiar with the neighborhoods. But there's a lot of talk, but when it comes to action, I just feel like people don't follow through. And, you know, I just really want to see some more specific stuff in terms of mental health care, you know, trauma training. Like, those are the reasons why cops are, you know, how are you going to create a relationship with the community when you can't even be honest about the problem in the first place?
No, that's right. I like that you pointed that out, that it is the system, because I think even in Baltimore, when talking about, and I know we have to move on, but in Baltimore, when talking about the policing and the issues with the police in Baltimore, a police chief from a while ago said something that I was like, oh, I can't believe I never even looked at it that way, that hiring more black officers doesn't fix the system, even though you should. Obviously, your police department should be diverse, but if the system is broken, you just, anybody new that you hire just falls into that.
Yeah, no.
So, yeah. All right, I guess we're gonna switch from Julian Castro and police to Pete Buttigieg, did a town hall with MSNBC last night where he answered a lot of questions. And we're gonna highlight a couple of them here for you. So an audience member stood up and expressed frustration with Congress as far as impeachment on Trump. And so he was asked directly what his thoughts about that were. And after a really long kind of explanation of what impeachment is, he said this.
No one ought to be above the law. That it matters that there is a majority.
Mayor, I've got a follow-up. And it's to sort of nail you down.
Yeah.
If you were voting in Congress right now on impeachment, would you vote to impeach?
Yeah, I would.
Okay, good.
Right, it took a really long time to get to that, though. There was 2.5 minutes that I saved you from. It took a really long time to get to that, but I mean.
Everybody's scared of Donald Trump, though, right. A lot of them. And, you know, because look at Michael Avenatti. He will make sure that you see to it. He'll see to it that you pay for messing with him. You know, I've heard a lot about the impeachment talk, but I also, I would like to hear more about, from the legal minds, about indictment. Because I think impeachment would be the easy route. Mm-hmm. I would like to see people pay for the crimes that they did commit. And, you know, specifically someone like Donald Trump, who, as we will talk about the Central Park Five, the exonerated five,
yes,
he so adamantly went after those kids and trying to get them not just in jail, but to capital punishment.
Killed, yeah.
And they were innocent. How about him? You know, when is he going to be held accountable for breaking the law?
Yeah. Another thing on Pete that floored me, and I want to get your thoughts on this. So at one point, he's asked about former Senator Al Franken and the Democrats who pushed him to resign. Mm-hmm. Although he quit voluntarily amid sexual misconduct allegations. Here is Mayor Pete's response when asked, should Al Franken have been forced out?
I think it was his decision to make, but I think the way that we basically held him to a higher standard than the GOP does their people has been used against us.
Do you think he should have been pushed to leave?
Again, it was his decision. I think that.
But I'm not asking about his decision. Should the other members of the Democratic caucus in the Senate, starting at the top, Chuck Schumer down, and the other people that pushed him to get out, they put a lot of pressure on him to leave. Were they right or wrong?
Well, I think it's not a bad thing that we hold ourselves to a higher standard.
But were they right to do that, to push him out of the Senate? Because they did.
I would not have applied that pressure at that time before we knew more.
Yeah, Because not only were there allegations, there was a photo of the hand photo and.
Yeah, but there was also a backstory to that photo.
Wasn't she asleep though?
I don't know if she was asleep, but what I did know was that, what I did hear was that there was ongoing behavior.
Yes.
And it was, it only became an issue at this point. I don't know. I'm not gonna shame a woman for being
for sure.
Whatever. I just don't know the story. I understand what he's saying about Democrats holding each other to a higher standard and not having a fight within them, because I do, Cenk and I talk about that often. But I just have a problem with any politician who has difficulties answering a question.
This whole thing, that's all it was. Yeah. The whole thing.
There was no, and where was this guy? We needed him to talk to Kamala. Because he was like, yeah, I know that M&Ms are red and blue, but I want to know if you like the green one. And so he was like, yeah, green is nice, but you know, red, it's just like, why can't you answer the question?
Just answer the question, exactly. You're running for president. Tell us what you think, answer questions, and answer yes or no questions. Don't waste my time. And speaking of time, we're not gonna waste your time, okay? We're gonna be right back in a jiffy, talking about a development in the Central Park Five. Not a development necessarily, as much as another side of the story that you may not know about. We'll be right back.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Hey there, welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm Brooke Thomas here with Ida Rodriguez. John is out this week. He is on a much needed vacation. All right, this is probably my favorite story of the morning. This is a story I really wanted to be able to talk about. It's a follow-up to the Exonerated Five. You're right, because we should stop calling them the Central Park Five. But it's another aspect of the story. You all know the story. We've talked about it. We've talked about it repeatedly. We were just talking about it yesterday. But I want to keep talking about it because I want this information and the issues, the many issues surrounding this problem. I want it fresh in everyone's mind. But so, a pretty amazing story in The Cut yesterday actually takes a look at another set of victims in this bubble of injustice. Okay, this is actually all of the women who may not have been raped or attacked had investigators focus their search on the right attacker. And one woman, a mother of three, she was pregnant at the time, one woman who may still be alive. So just when I just get right into it, it says, you know, this wasn't about one young, white, affluent woman raped while jogging in Central Park, but about nine young women, some affluent, some less so, assaulted, raped, or murdered all around the Upper East Side. The story crafted within hours of that April 19 night was the splintered mirror image of the real narrative that the man who attacked the Central Park jogger was a serial rapist and murderer who struck before and after. And we kind of put together a timeline because I want you to see exactly what we're talking about here. So the real attacker, the serial rapist and murderer, Reyes, that's his name. And these are his victims, the survivors of his attack. So in September 21st of 1988, this is his first known victim, if he attacked Jackie Herbach in September of 1988, and two down, there's Trisha, the Central Park survivor. So the longer part of the list happens after her attack.
Right, of course.
So if Linda Fairstein potentially wasn't so obsessed with manipulating the facts in this situation and essentially railroading these five little boys, maybe someone's mother could still be alive.
Absolutely. I went to her Twitter because I saw that people were tweeting her, and I was fascinated with the fact that CBS still employs her, mm-hmm. and that she's still out there because she's a criminal to me and all of the people that weren't involved in this. But that's what happens a lot. You know, it happens that while people of color are being unjustly accused of crimes, it gives free rein to those people who are actually committing the crimes to go out, because this became such a big, you know, I mean, such a big media deal. So unfortunately, all of those people should be suing. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
It shouldn't just be the exonerated five men, but the victims of the people who continue to suffer as a result of this, you know, crucifixion, this public humiliation, and you know, it was like the Salem witch trials,
yeah.
Like these witch trials, the way that they behave towards those children. And listen, when people come for Linda Fairstein, which I fully support, everybody involved, no one employed their consciousness at any moment to say, this is not okay. They're all guilty, and they should all feel the wrath and the karma of being part of a conspiracy to tragically interrupt the lives of five children. They were children. And the things that happened to them as a result of this, they are the victims. But yes, all of the other people that suffered because law enforcement, and this is a perfect example of what we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. law enforcement, local government, you know, the people above those cops that all participated in this.
And so speaking of exactly what you're talking about, just to show just specifically how many issues were going on here, the second victim, the second woman, her name is being withheld. This is what happened in her case, and this is 2 days before the Central Park attack. So police say she not only identified her attacker as a Hispanic man, but called attention to the fresh stitches on his chin. So when the detective checked local hospital records, he found that a man fitting that description had been given stitches at Metropolitan Hospital, and the man's name was Matias Reyes. The woman left New York not long after the attack and stopped talking to police. The detective assigned to this case was transferred to a different unit. The unsolved case was just closed within months, and Reyes was never brought in for questioning.
Of course, because that was an agenda point. They were going in they said, we have to have criminals. These guys fit it. In the movie, she kept saying, these animals,
right.
These animals. That's how that happens a lot.
But the two arguments don't fit, though, because in the same department, in the same system, one guy, you have a description, you don't even bring him in to ask him a question.
No.
And in, you know, and days later, you go out and just to corral little black boys in Harlem.
Because this wasn't about justice. This was political.
Right.
And it was a person who had so many L's in her book that she needed a win, and she was going to get that win at any cost. And that's why I tell you that you have to be just as vested in your local government as you are in the federal government, because these are the people, the sheriffs, the DAs, the public defenders, all of those people conspired, you know, to see this because they wanted, they thought about it politically. They thought about it. The people are all disposable and dispensable to these people. Everybody is a currency when you're poor and you're a person of color. This was never about justice and bringing someone to justice. It was about people's records, people appearing a certain way, people looking like they accomplished something. And there are a bunch of losers, you know, they should all be ashamed of themselves. All those men that sat there bullying those little boys, a bunch of losers.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Just so you know, just to give you an idea of how this man was finally caught, Reyes, his last victim after the attack, it's brutal, it's violent, it's horrifying. She was actually able to get away from him and run down the stairs in her apartment building to her superintendent's door. She ran down 3 flights of stairs with him basically right behind her. And a building porter and another tenant saw the man in the lobby, and before he could flee, they got to him and pinned him on a couch for 15 minutes until police arrived. And I just put that in perspective, just thinking about the fact that I'm so glad that, you know, but unfortunately, like, this had to happen after this woman was attacked. Mm-hmm. And after so many other women were attacked, when police, someone could have brought this man in for questioning.
Yeah, he was a white passing Hispanic, mm-hmm. and he did not fit the profile of what they did, what they wanted to be the demon in this story. Mm-hmm. And that is why you constantly hear the word animal when referring in the dehumanization of the young black boys, because that's what happens. It's the dehumanization is part of the process of the oppression. And, you know, that he didn't fit the narrative that they were trying to put out. Those kids in Central Park that were, I don't know, beating up bikers or whatever, which is not something that is specific to black people. That's something
absolutely
that young,
nobody even
young,
knows who was there. We do know that one of the boys that was arrested had a huge slash on his face after an officer had slammed him in the head with a helmet.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that makes it easier.
Yeah.
You keep calling them animals, and you don't want to see them at their humanity. That's why I love the title of it, is because it makes it easier to beat up on them, falsely accuse them, kill them, mm-hmm. because you don't see them as people.
Yeah. Ugh. I think.
And I feel sorry for those victims because.
Absolutely. You know, can you imagine? One of the women in there, and we didn't get deep into it, but the woman who lost her life, you know, her 2 7-year-old, 6 and I think 7-year-old sons, and baby, and she was pregnant at the time as well. We're all, you know, these kids were in the house and she had them go in the other room. And so they had to experience this. You know, they come out and see their mother all bloody and they're terrified, running and trying to find out how to call 911. And their mom passed away. And just to think that, you know, maybe this didn't have to happen.
No.
It shouldn't have.
And Linda, that police department, that city government, they should be compensating all of those victims because of their loss, because of their blind spot, because of their intentional, you know, hatred mm-hmm. towards people of color. All these people suffered.
Yeah, you're right, completely. All right, we'll be right back with lots more news for you. Stay with us. Hey there, welcome back to the Damage Report. We've got this is such a sad story, a horrifying development in a story we first talked about here weeks ago on the Damage Report. A little girl missing from Houston, 4-year-old Malia Davis. Sadly, she has been confirmed dead. The medical examiner confirms her remains were actually found in Arkansas 1 month after she went missing. On Friday, law enforcement officials in Fulton, Arkansas, they said a road crew found a black bag with a foul odor and inside were bones and blood. Community activist Quanell X out of Houston, who advocated for Malia's mother, Brittany Bowens, told ABC 13 Eyewitness News of the discovery. And hours earlier, he actually told reporters that the suspect in the disappearance, Darian Vance, confessed that the girl died by accident and told him her body was dumped in Arkansas. Darian Vance is this little girl's mother's ex-fiance. He is still in jail. He has been in jail since May 11th. Right now, he's only charged with tampering with a corpse. And you may remember in this story, initially, Vince said that she was kidnapped while in his care. He said some men came, knocked him over the head, kidnapped him, but then dropped him and his son off and took the little girl, and he went to the hospital with his son. And this was all why this little girl was in his care. Her mom was out of town for a funeral. Police later found the little girl on surveillance video with him and found blood evidence in his apartment. So they were able to arrest him and charge him with tampering with a corpse. And there's been a lot of talk about this story. You know, we talked to an attorney specifically about this and about potential charges, and a lot of people want the mother to be charged because he was abusive, and she admitted that he had been abusive to the little girl. He had been abusive to her, and she wanted to get away, but she still left out of town and left the little girl with him in his care. But also, you know, she has been a victim of abuse her whole life, and so then there's that argument in this. This is another one of those stories that I want to keep going. I feel so awful for this little girl, thinking about how terrible her life must have been, and like those last moments, and how scary. And nobody deserves this.
No, it's awful. I'm a have an unpopular opinion here. But I do think the mom should be held accountable. I'm tired of reading stories about women whose children end up dead because of their poor choices. And listen, when you say to somebody, well, she was abused, a lot of us have been abused. That does not give you an excuse. It doesn't relieve you of culpability. You left your daughter with a man who had already abused your child, and you didn't report it for 24 hours. You didn't report it until the following day. Another child was with this man who has a history. This is, you know, how deep the rhetoric that's going on in this country and the divide and the conquer. And he said it was Mexicans who kidnapped the little girl. That is how much the use of language that this administration has put into our climate, that people now say Mexicans, and it instantly makes people like, oh, they must, because they're rapists and they're murderers, people are going to believe that some Mexicans kidnapped because they have human trafficking on at the border.
That was part of his shield. You're completely right.
Yeah,
that was part of his shield, using that as a way, because I think he knew that there was a chance that the fact that his story was flimsy would be overlooked by this desire to hate Latin Americans.
Yeah, and to put that out there. And, you know, I just think that everybody needs to be held accountable. If it was a mistake, Quanell X, assalamu alaikum, brother. If it was a mistake, then the crime is not just in the actual murder, but in the covering up, the lying of it, the creating this false story, you know, putting police out there and using taxpayers' dollars to look for criminals that don't exist because it's a lie. There's so much part of this whole story. And at the end of the day, for me, our young black girls who are often the victims of so many crimes, you see it with R. Kelly, they call you, you're out to destroy black men when you defend young black women. No, that there is an agenda in America that is oppressive to black men, and there is an agenda that ignores the lives of black women. And this is not okay, young black girls. So for me, I think he should go to jail, and I think she should go to jail. And do we want sympathy for them? Absolutely. While they're serving time for being negligent in the loss of a life of a child that they were responsible for caring for.
I do just like often, like, how many aspects of his abuse were, was he helped in hiding it? You know what I mean? By systems around them. Was there a daycare worker? Was there, and not that this would be their fault, but I just wonder, you know, how we're used to seeing dysfunction so much people on the outside
the
didn't
mother
know
knew.
That this was alarm. Yeah, but you know what I mean? Yeah.
She knew something was wrong. She didn't want to say it because she probably felt that she might look guilty, because she is guilty because she left her child with an abuser.
And now we have a 4-year-old girl who won't ever turn 5. It's just a sad story. Just every time we see pictures of her, this is a sad story. And I'm thinking about her.
Me too.
Yeah, and absolutely.
So if I'm,
And you're a mom, so I get it.
No, I just think, I've watched the cases over and over again of all these little black girls who come up missing. You know, I have the privilege of being brown in America, which is supposed to be something, but I don't even know what it's like to be, you know, an African-American black girl in America. And life for me ain't been no crystal stairs. So when I think about these cases, I think about how many young black girls get overlooked, who get missing and don't get reported. It doesn't become a national issue. There is no Malaya alert. There's an Amber alert. You know what I mean? So when I think about all of this stuff, at some point we're gonna have to get into the nitty gritty and start holding people accountable for everything that they do to our children.
Absolutely. All right, we gotta take a quick break. We'll be right back. Hey there, welcome back to the Damage Report. Now we're gonna talk TYT investigates, because Ken Klippenstein is always breaking stories, and yesterday broke a really interesting story and got a hold of some documents regarding ICE detainee deaths, people who were in ICE custody. And we're going to talk all about that and what he found, what he learned. Ken Klippenstein, good morning.
Hey, Brooke, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming on. So you got a hold of some internal documents. Can you tell us what you found and what you learned?
Well, you know, I don't have high expectations for the conduct of ICE, but I was pretty shocked by this. What the documents show, which was a memo from an ICE supervisor to the acting director, you know, recall that Trump still hasn't appointed an actual director for ICE, as with so many government agencies. This memo to the acting director said that numerous deaths had been preventable, that systems, basic healthcare systems that you'd even find in, you know, other government institutions are not in place at ICE. That's causing people to both die and suffer, you know, terrible injury and pain, and that nothing was being done to address this.
In there, specifically in the email, there was something. The whole email was jaw dropping, and there were some specific points that I want to talk about. ICE's Health Services Corp was severely dysfunctional. Can you break that down a little bit more?
Yeah, in bureaucrat speak, that's kind of the worst thing you can say. Uh-huh. Recall that this is a memo. This is not, you know, some kind of political statement or anything. So you're not going to see the same sort of colorful language that you might from the activist community. But what the document detailed was just, you know, probably over a dozen cases in which really basic systems that you would find in any, you know, serious healthcare facility were not in place. To give you a few examples, there are people described as having, you know, textbook reactions to certain medications that are life-threatening, and there was no response to it. There are multiple cases of there being these incident reports that were reported to ICE Health's leadership saying, you know, this is a serious, maybe you have someone who's suicidal or someone who, another case was someone manifesting symptoms of a stroke, and then he had a stroke. I believe it was days later when he didn't get the treatment that he needed. So what you see again and again is indications of, you know, really serious health incidents and no response, what to speak of, in numerous cases.
Hi there, Ken. How are you? It's Ida. How many people had were copied on that email? I mean, how many people had access to this information within the organizations?
It was just to the acting director, but my understanding is that when you send something like that to the acting director, you know, that's the whole institution is supposed to see it at that point.
Wow.
That's the highest you can escalate to within ICE.
Wow. And how many deaths on record?
10 kids at this point, right? At least, right?
And then within the letter itself, there's at least 3 deaths that are detailed and described as preventable with, you know, with background information. And it's not clear from the document if there's more than that, but we know there's at least 3. And this is just, you know, one supervisor.
Wow. There was something else specifically in here about the level of detainees with serious mental disorders just completely ignored. One sentence, just word for word, says even a layperson could identify detainees with obvious psychosis. And these are significant issues, significant problems. How can so many of these preventable mistakes be happening to this level without it being intentional?
I think it certainly rises to the level of neglect. Uh-huh. And that's, you know, what people in ICE have told me, and also attorneys, immigration attorneys have told me. I think it certainly rises to the level of neglect. Whether this is base incompetence or, you know, malice, it's really hard to say, but I think you're exactly right to, you know, raise that question about what, you know, what's going on here. If this is happening, as I note in the story, quoting an ICE official, that this is happening on a systemic basis. These are not bad apples. This is across the board stuff that appears to be happening. So yeah, I think that's a legitimate question.
You mentioned the ICE people that you've talked to. How many of those people would you say? What percentage would you say actually care about those human beings that they're being detained? Because if someone is talking to you, they have some level of a conscience. Mm-hmm. So how many of those people would you say, or what percentage do you think that it's just such a minority that there is no hope? Or is there a possibility that we could probably make some changes if people actually started standing up?
I absolutely think changes could be made. First of all, if you look at polling, things like family separation, extremely unpopular even among Republicans, I should say. So this is not a fringe issue by any means. I don't think you even necessarily have to be a progressive to care about this stuff. But to give you a sense, I've done a number of stories on ICE, and I've always been amazed at the degree of internal dissension within the agency by people who are not by any means liberals or progressives. I don't want to get into too much specifics to protect my sources, yeah. but these are not lefty activists by any means, and they're just horrified. I mean, I talked to someone a few months ago who said to me, this person worked in enforcement and removal. These are the folks that actually, there are different components within ICE. These are the folks that actually put people in the paddy wagons and split the families. He said, I wanted to fight drug gangs. I didn't know I was going to be tearing apart families. He felt really bad about it. And that's a sentiment I've seen a shocking number of times. So I came into this amazed because I thought of ICE as one sort of monolithic institution, and there are a lot of different parts within it. As I detail in the story, there's a healthcare component. There are also people that were moved here after 9/11. Recall that DHS, ICE's parent organization, is very new. This is not a very old organization. This came into being after 9/11 under Bush. And so a lot of people were moved in there and shuffled in there from other agencies. And those in particular tend to be the ones that seem really dissatisfied with the direction the institution has gone. So I'd say there's plenty of space for people willing to talk to the press and whistleblowers willing to come forward.
Ken, did this email result in any changes within this department? Anybody fired? What happened before, obviously, this was made public?
I can only go off of what my sources are saying. And my understanding is that it didn't result in anything within the agency. What we're going to have to see now is what making this public will lead to, because we've had, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar just tweeted it out. I keep getting emails from congressional staffers interested in this stuff. So there definitely seems to be an appetite to do it. And if the public can kind of pressure Congress, I think we could absolutely see changes. But when this memo was written internally, my understanding is that it didn't lead to any sort of response.
Wow. Ken, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Really, really great job on this. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, we'll be right back with a couple more interesting stories to wrap this all up. It's been a great day so far.
Yeah, terrible news, but great day.
Terrible news, terrible news. Right, stay with us. Hey there, another Democratic 2020 hopeful went on Fox News for a town hall. We're talking about Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Host Chris Wallace asked her to explain an old tweet. All right, so last year she tweeted this: "Our future is female, intersectional, powered by our belief in one another, and we're just getting started." So Chris asked her to explain this. She answered, and so he interrupted. Watch.
"We want women to have a seat at the table.
What about men?
They're already there. Do you not know?"
I mean, come on. And listen, here's the thing. Elizabeth Warren told y'all. Kamala also said no, and nobody wants to listen. That's ridiculous, and that's so insulting. And I do think you put yourself in that position too. Elizabeth Warren has repeatedly had to explain why she won't go on this network.
Mm-hmm. That's the All Lives Matter argument.
That's the
man's version of All Lives Matter. What about men? What about men? What about the state of the world today, thanks to many men, that we are constantly still fighting for basic fundamental rights as human beings, being people of color, being women, being gay, being transgender? It's just like when somebody says that's the most tone deaf. And I'm glad she handled it the way
she
that she did.
Yeah. And you know what? Somebody told a joke years ago when I was working in Memphis. And he didn't mean anything by it. It was a young guy who was part of the crew. And so one of our employees, and he asked, he didn't think it was fair that there was an NAACP. And so he was like, why isn't there an NAACP for white people? And one of the A's in NAACP stands for advancement. And so my co-anchor at the time said, because you can't advance past the front of the line.
That's right.
And it's like people don't even think about that. That's what this reminded me of. And what about a man? But so she had something to say about Fox too. This was kind of an interesting back and forth here. An audience member, a retired nurse, actually asked what Gillibrand's position is on late-term abortions. Take a look.
And what we have created, unfortunately, is a false choice and a false narrative. And Chris, I want to talk about the role that Fox News plays in this, because it's a problem. I can tell you, before President Trump gave his State of the Union, Fox News talked about infanticide. Infanticide doesn't exist, Senator.
I just want to say we brought you here for an hour. We have given you, we're treating you very fairly. I understand that maybe to make your credentials with the Democrats who are not appearing on Fox News, you want to attack us. I'm not sure it's frankly very polite when we've invited you to be here.
I will do it in a polite way, but it's to her point.
Well, I just think, why don't we instead of talking about Fox News, why don't you answer Susan's question?
You know what's funny is that I listen, y'all come for me if you want. I think it's ridiculous, preposterous, and absolutely laughable that somebody on Fox News says it's not polite.
Okay. And don't you dare say that to a woman. Don't respectability politics. Or she was being polite. She was politely saying, I think you do bad stuff. But she was smiling.
Yeah, that's how they do it.
Right.
They laugh at people.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm so tired of that question. That the extreme question is always the question when it comes. What do you think about late term abortion? The nurse asked the woman candidate. I think that what she thinks about it. Do you want to hear if she's thinks it's right or wrong? And of course, it is her job to be real about what is perpetuating this false narrative that continues to gaslight these issues. And as a woman, he did a disservice to her because he did not allow her to answer the question. He immediately jumped to the defense. A guilty mind needs no accusing. He could have just sat right there and been quiet and allowed her to finish answering her question, because he made it worse.
Absolutely, he made it worse, and because now we're focused on it and we're looking at that. Mm-hmm. Speaking of worse, how about worse for all humans forever? Vice has a new climate change report out suggesting humankind, listen to this y'all, may cease to exist by 2050. Did you hear that? Does everybody in the room hear that? Humankind, 2050 is 31 years away, okay? In our current trajectory, the report warns, planetary and human systems are reaching a point of no return by mid-century, in which the prospect of a largely uninhabitable Earth leads to the breakdown of nations and the international order. Going forward, to say the results would be devastating. Some 1 billion people would be forced to attempt to relocate from unlivable conditions, and 2 billion would face scarcity of water supplies. Agriculture would collapse in the subtropics, and food production would suffer dramatically worldwide. The internal cohesion of nation states like the US and China would unravel.
It makes me want to say good. You know,
it's like
a bad game of Sims. And we should just start all over.
Restart the computer.
And then we'll see how those billions of dollars will serve you during the apocalypse. You know what I mean? Because that's the problem, is that this unbalance, I don't know what makes people think, whether you're Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, there is a natural order, right? And the lack of balance will eventually lead to chaos, because how much longer do you think you're gonna disrespect the earth, mistreat the earth, poison the earth, mistreat the people, the poor people, the people of color, the First Nations people, women? How much do you think is going to continue? This is going to continue, and that it's not going to rear its ugly head. So sometimes I hate to say that, because I have children, I have family, I love people, I know so many great humans. But sometimes I think maybe a wash might be the best thing we need, and let's start all over again and see how it works out in the future. Maybe those that come after us will have some humanity, and what makes you rich is how many carrots you have in your yard and not in your ears.
I mean, well, if you believe this report and look at what's actually being happened by our country's leaders, they're kind of saying that too.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So this has been more fantastic than I could have ever expected. Ida Rodriguez on the Damage Report. How are we so lucky?
I love y'all. So lucky?
Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for watching.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.